Good morning, everybody. Two announcements. First, next week Thursday, no lecture. I have something different. I mean, the trick is that we have just 3 hours a week and we do four, and so once a while we just skip one lecture, okay? Due to my schedule constraints. So next Thursday, no lecture. Okay, so be aware of that. Next Thursday, best lecture ever. Just stay at home in bed and enjoy life. Yeah? This is the 27th of November. Okay? If you show up here, I will not show up, so you can have an exercise lecture or something like that. Good. The next problem is what is the time frame for the applications or the registration for the oral exam? When does the period end? 28. Because I have not yet decided on the days when I will have the orals, so I have to do this week. Okay, good. And last examination period, a few students they just mixed up the date when they have the oral exam, so they showed up 1 day later. I have to tell you that my schedule is that much squeezed that I have not so much flexibility. So if you miss the day and the time, we will have a problem. Sometimes I do it on Saturdays, but sometimes I cannot squeeze it in. So in this case, I was very sorry that we have to postpone it for another 6 months, the exam. Yeah, that's not good for you. I know that. That is a pity, and please be aware of that. And the students also signed, you know. We have a list, and they also signed that they are going to come, and then we couldn't do anything if the students screw it up. Okay? Be aware of that. We try to do what we can for you, but at some point, if we have a limited period of time for doing the exam, sometimes it doesn't fit anymore in our schedule. Okay. Good. Yes, sir.
Do you know a rough date for the exam?
No, not yet. I said I have to decide on that.
I
will have 1 day at the beginning and 2 days at the end, so you can decide on that. Huh? And you can be very flexible, so you can have the exam with me or with Andreas. So whatever is fine, and Andreas is not harder than I am in the exam, I guess. So it doesn't matter which way you go. I hope so. At least that's what I have heard. Okay, good. So DMIP. We talk about reconstruction this time. I'm not looking at the whole story now. And reconstruction is a very wide field. How can we compute higher dimensional information from lower dimensional information? And what we focus on here first is 3D reconstruction from X-ray. That means we reconstruct higher dimensional structures from X-ray projections. Yeah? And if we talk about X-ray projections, we have to remember Beer's law. Once again, this is something you have to burn into the outer shell of your brain. That means that the observed intensity value is given by I0 times minus integral fxy. Dx dy integrated over a line L. Yeah, so we integrate along a line L, and last week we have also shown how we can reformulate the integration along a line by using Dirac delta function. We know that a line is given by a normal vector and by the offset from the origin. And that's why we can write the integral, the double integral over x and y fx y times delta x cosine theta plus y sine theta minus d, if d is the offset, dx dy. No? So that is Beer's law. And I think I was not that clear on Monday in terms of projection direction and detector orientation. So once again, if this is our detector, this is our projection direction. That means that's the direction we project things on. And this here is the rotation angle, theta. The rotation angle, and so we can set up things like the equation of the straight line in terms of the projection direction and things like that. So these are the mathematical constraints, and reconstruction basically means take different line integrals. So we measure line integrals. If you look at an X-ray image, this is just an array of line integral measurements, and compute out of that this function. That means the original function, the X-ray particles were propagated through. This here in this example is a 2D function. In 3D, we would get an additional dimension here. Yeah? And the reconstruction can be done in various ways. And we have seen last week a very simple example where we have considered the 2x2 case. So we end up basically with the problem I0 is integral fx y integrated over the line and we have seen or we know that integrals can be approximated by a discrete sum and so we ended up by solving a problem like ax is p where this is the function to be or the discrete version of the function to be reconstructed and this here is the observation the projection I0 normalized and the algorithm logarithmized and this here is the system matrix carrying the geometry. The system matrix carries the geometry, so independent of the measurements, the A is fixed. It's just defined by the setup, the geometrical setup and the geometry of the projection lines we have. Yeah? And we have seen a very special case where we have a 2x2 object to be reconstructed, and we had the curious situation that the matrix A was even singular, so there was no unique solution. Okay? And what we are currently looking into is building up reconstruction algorithms that go right into the integral representation. And what we have introduced, and that's why I brought up this slide on the right-hand side, was the sinogram. We brought up the sinogram. So have the following image in mind. You have your 2D plane. You have your 2D object. Yeah. You have your 2D object, and you propagate parallel projection lines through the object. And you have here your detector. And you have here your detector. So this point here on the detector is first of all defined by the coordinate in the coordinate system of the detector. And this coordinate we call in the future just S. That's the S element on our detector element. Okay? So the S element on our detector element. And if we that's an intrinsic parameter in terms of our notation we have used in projection modeling, because this is something that sits on the detector. And if you move around the detector, the S position is still indexed by S. It doesn't matter where the detector is. And there is an extrinsic coordinate, and that's the rotation angle. The rotation angle of the detector around the object. So let's call this theta, that's the rotation angle. And so we can describe a measurement by P of theta S, where theta is the rotation angle, the extrinsic parameter, and S is the index on the detector. And what we can do now is we can have a picture, an image generated out of the projections. Think about the following. We have a one-dimensional detector line. We rotate the detector line around the patient, around the object, and do X-ray measurements. So for rotation angle 0, we get a projection line. Yeah? We measure the X-ray line of this structure here for angle 0. For angle 1 degree, we get a second one. For angle 3 degrees, 4, 5, and so on. And this structure here is called sinogram. This is called sinogram. And if you look what happens if you generate a sinogram, you can look at this example here. This is one of the older set of slides. So we have this object, okay, where we have these two corners. This is a square where just the corners are visible. And now think about the following. You have your X-ray projection going through it, and the black and the white pixels here, they have different attenuation values. And that means, and here the sinogram is rotated a little bit, if you project, for instance, from this direction through the object, you will see two points in the projection, because these two, they sit on the same projection line, so they are overlaid. Okay? That means in the sinogram, you have here two points. And then you rotate a little bit, and then the projection of the two points will no longer coincide, but they will show up as two different points. That's exactly what's going to happen here, right? You have one point, the second point, the third point, the fourth point. So in the sinogram, if you look at the projections from two points that you originally observe, this grows line by line in four points, and they diverge. It's clear that they diverge. If you think about having a projection line like this, these two points are projected here on two different points, and these two as well. So I have four points. And what happens if I have the rotation angle 45 degrees? These two points sit on a single projection line. And these two sit on different ones. So in my sinogram, I will see 3 points in the projection. And that's exactly what happens, for instance, here. You see it? 1, 2, 3. So you know this is the 45 degree rotation. Then I have again 2 points. That means I have this projection direction. Then there should be 3 points again, 2 points again, yeah, and so on. And that's the sinogram that you can generate out of these points. So a good idea is to practice the understanding of this a little bit, draw a point and rotate around the structure and draw the sinogram, draw 2 points and just grow into a good understanding what is this. And what the X-ray scanner does, yeah? The X-ray scanner, while rotating around the patient, is it generates out of your brain, for instance, or out of my brain, a sinogram. And what the reconstruction task means, construct or reconstruct out of the sinogram this original structure. Yeah, that's image reconstruction. We cannot measure the original function, but line integrals from different directions. We can put them into the sinogram, the measurements, and the reconstruction algorithms are doing nothing else but just transform it into this. Yeah? And if you look at more complex structures, this is the so-called Shep-Logan phantom. That's an artificial phantom that is used by many reconstruction, computer vision reconstruction experts to evaluate new reconstruction algorithms, where you have predefined regions and you well know what the function values are. And you can generate for this here the sinogram. Let's look whether this sinogram is plausible to us. Yeah? Does the lecturer show a sinogram that makes sense? Yeah? Well, if you look at this elliptic structure here, for sure, if you project the elliptic structure on this detector, it will have a width like this, right? It will show the smaller axis of the ellipses. If you rotate around for 90 degrees, you should have the large axis of the ellipses, and then you get the small one back. So the shape of the sinogram should go up and down due to the structure of the Shep-Logan, okay? And this is exactly what we observe here. And internally here, within the structure, we see gray values. And we see some, periodic structures, yes, but it's not easy to, or it's basically impossible for us to look at the sinogram and do a reconstruction like this. I never met someone who can just look at the sinogram and gets a good imagination what's the object in 3D. Yeah? Or you can use the picture of Röntgen. Yeah? Of Röntgen, and if you generate the sinogram, for instance, of a portrait photo, you get something like this. Yeah? And, when I had a PhD student who was expert or who did 5 years of research on reconstruction, you know how the PhD defense in our lab works. You have the official exam and then your colleagues do another exam. And only if you succeed in the other exam, you get your PhD degree. And his task was to identify colleagues based on the sinograms. Okay, very, very interesting. So take a picture of your boyfriend or girlfriend. If you don't know what to give them for Christmas, yeah? Just print, use MATLAB, take a picture of you, generate a sinogram, yeah? Let it print, put it in a nice frame, and they will be excited for sure, yeah? For sure. Okay, good. We all agree that this was a, we all agree that now we have a very good intuitive understanding of projection. Janje? Yeah? Really? Of course. Good. No, Yixin, right? Sorry. You should correct me. I mean, that's the problem I have with my all my Chinese students. I cannot remember the names. I always mix them up. So it's my limited brain power. Oh, what happened here? Oh. Hmm. And I will just take the slides as they are here. I thought they. Okay, and what we are now going to look into in more detail, we are now following the idea that I have illustrated, or I stole it from Zeng's book, the illustration. Let's assume we have our measurements, yeah, and we just have one point on the detector that was measured. And we have the projection geometry pre-calibrated. We know how the X-ray particles are propagated through the object. What we can do now is we can just take the detector element and smear it along the projection line through the object. That means we take the detector line and intersect the detector line successively with the function we want to reconstruct. And at those point where the detector line, the virtual detector line then intersects with the volume, we just add up the points or the function values that we have measured. That means, again, you have here your detector, you have here your projection line, and this is the function to be reconstructed. We now intersect the volume to be reconstructed with parallel lines to the detector, and we just add up to the elements that we want to reconstruct the values that we have measured on the corresponding detector line element. So we take the element, the values of the detector line, and we just enter these values here. We move the detector line, we enter the values here, we move the detector line, and we enter the values here. Yeah? This is not written in the script, so you have to remember this for the oral exam. Good. Yeah? And then I take another view, smear it through the object, add up the values. And it's clear if I have one point here and the rest is zero, one point here and the rest is zero, at the position where the point sits in the 2D function we want to reconstruct, these values will accumulate. Okay? So that's exactly what's described here. You have smeared back the measured values for each projection. For each projection, I get at the point where, or at the position where the point shows up in the projection, one line through the reconstructed object. Because if this here, for instance, is the measurement one and here zero, I have ones all over there. And I have ones all over there. So I will have stripes in my image, okay? I will have streak artifacts in my image. But at this point where the original point in 3D sits, I will get a higher value because they all intersect there. Okay? And the closer I am to the point, the closer are the streaks where I set up the ones, and I have a discrete function, so it's clear the closer I get to the object, the higher the entries will grow. Yeah? And that's exactly the type of values I observe at the end in the image around the point. And now the idea is, why don't we filter in advance the function on the detector in a way that we have negative values close to the point that we want to reconstruct, and make this shape here smaller, smaller, and smaller due to a pre-filtering operation. And that's exactly what modern CT scanners do in terms of intuition. Yeah? They smear back the measurements, but do a high-pass filtering in advance that make the resulting image not blurred, but as sharp and clean as possible. And now we have to find the theory for proving this. What we have now intuitively characterized. Okay? Anyone in the lecture hall who is not following this simple idea? For those who were a little late, next Thursday, no lecture, Stefan. Okay? Was that offending that I was calling you by name? No. It's recorded, so. I'm pretty much convinced that history researchers will look at the videos 500 years from now in very much detail and draw certain conclusions about the way I'm teaching and the psychology of the lecturer and things like that. And you know what? I don't care. So, ladies and gentlemen, now the most important theorem for CT reconstruction will be explained to you. Yeah? So listen carefully. You will find all this on the slides and in hundreds and thousands of textbooks and presentation slides you find in the web. The idea is not very difficult, and the concept goes as follows. So let's look again at the 2D, 1D situation. At the end of the day, we have a 2D detector and we want to reconstruct 3D objects, but for explaining things, it's always easier to look at 2D functions that have to be reconstructed with a one-dimensional detector. So we reconstruct just one slice in the brain, for instance. Okay, this is our object coordinate system. Here is our object, yeah, that we want to reconstruct. Okay? This is the object to be reconstructed. The object. Now I have to look a little bit that I do not mix up the notation. Okay, good. Now we look at this projection. This is one-dimensional. It's a 1D projection. That means we project this object with parallel projection lines on this detector here. And this detector function is called P of S and theta, where theta is the rotation angle and S is the index on the detector. Okay? intrinsic and extrinsic coordinate. In this case, let's assume this is the rotation angle 0, okay? Okay? You can't do that now in your notes, but I can. This is the rotation angle 0. So we look at the very special case that our rotation angle is 0. So far, so good. And now I told you last week that we will look into, or on Monday, into Fourier transforms and use Fourier transform for reconstruction. Yeah? So without being too smart, we can say, ah, he was telling us something about Fourier transform, so what might be the next step we want to consider? The Fourier transform of it. So why don't we just Fourier transform this, okay? So we have the, we are a genius and we have the brilliant idea. Compute the Fourier transform of P of S. And you know, we are lazy and we want to make it as simple as possible. So let's start with P of S0, okay? So we just compute the Fourier transform. So we have the Fourier transform. The one-dimensional Fourier transform, I just write here a 1, because later on we will also look into 2D Fourier transforms, of P, S, 0. Well, and then we take the definition of the Fourier transform and we ignore the coefficients. Yeah, this is the hand-waving math lecture you are attending this semester. Okay, so the integral of minus infinity plus infinity of P of S 0 E. And then we take the, we carry the pi with us because it's also used in the book that we reference. So we have 2 pi I omega S and we integrate, of course, over all the S. Now, this is the degree of freedom of our function. This is a function in S where theta was constant or is constant, and we compute just the Fourier transform of the one-dimensional function. Okay? So what you can do is you can take the picture of your boy or girlfriend. You can compute the sinogram. You decide on one line in the sinogram that is associated with the rotation angle 0, and you take this out. You put it into the 1D Fourier transform, and you get as a result a 1D Fourier transform that is this one here. In the discrete, the integral is replaced by a sum. Okay? What? Ludwig?
That thing about when you give it to your girlfriend, you say just like, I wish you a Merry Christmas, that's you align.
Yeah, if you decided on the right girl, then it's. Okay. I'm not sure about the reaction of my wife. Well, I'm pretty much sure about it, I have to say. Yeah. It's the other way around. But she's very nice. She would say, oh, that's wonderful. But she will never use it. Okay, now we have computed the sinogram. And the Fourier transform of one line in the sinogram that is associated with a detector line that is carrying the rotation angle 0. Okay? Good. So far, so good. So we have integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of P of S 0. I just write it again because we have to practice this a little bit. Minus 2 pi I omega s ds. So, and now let's think about how did we get P of S0? We get P of S0 by looking at our object function f of x and y, and by projecting the function x and y according to Baer's law. We have reformulated Bayer's law in terms of dividing by I0, applying the logarithm and multiplying with minus one. These are the values that we actually have observed. And this is nothing else but the integral of the 2D function along this projection line, okay? So we just use the definition of this projection, and the definition was we take the original function f, x, and y, and we project this function along this line here, 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 and along this line here. This is corresponding to the function values we get if we take the 2D function and integrate the 2D function over all x for y is 0. Do you see that? If I set y is 0 and I integrate the function over over all the values here, hold on. Now I have turned it around. Here is the x coordinate, here is the y coordinate. So I have my detector element here for x is 0, and I integrate for all the y values from minus infinity to plus infinity.
For x is s.
Huh?
For
and
x is s.
For x is s, yeah. Yeah, that means I integrate now the function along this line here. So p of s 0 is the integral for x is s, and we integrate over I have to think again. I integrate now here over all the values of y. Right. Yeah. Okay. Over y. Good. So we go into this minus integral to plus minus infinity to plus infinity integral over f of s, so I replace this over y dy over all from minus infinity to plus infinity e to the power of minus pi omega s ds. Okay? You agree on that? Then I have integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, minus infinity to plus infinity. And now I rename s and I just call it x, okay? Then it's easier to see for you. Okay, I just did that. Yes, sir? We have two integrations here over. Yeah? No, it's fine. Ask. It's fine. Okay? And now I do say this does not depend on y, so I can bring this into the integral. So I'm just reorganizing things. And now I do the following. I now write plus eta plus 0 times y. No, I add just 0 times y, which is, that is 0. So nothing serious happened. Okay? I just added here 0 times y. And now I go back. And because it's always easier from your perspective to look at things, What do you see if you look at this? You see two integrals, right? Two integrals. And you see here omega x plus eta y, where eta is 0. And here is the function. And then you go back and say, hey, that is the two-dimensional Fourier transform at the point omega 0 in frequency space. That's exactly what's written here. If I write here instead of 0 and eta, you would say that's the Fourier transform omega of the function fxy at the position omega eta in Fourier space. That's just the definition of the 2D Fourier transform. Yeah? This is just the definition of the 2D Fourier transform. So this is nothing else but the FK2 of F of x and y at the position omega 0. Yeah? Ludwig, you agree on that?
Yes, I do.
You do. It's just the definition, yeah? With the only difference that here the second component here is set to 0. If I ask you, write down the 2D Fourier transform of the function fx, you would write exactly this, where you here would use a second variable. And we just choose the variable to be 0. And now let's look at the geometry again. Oh man, is that cool. What does that mean? If I take this function here, you should look more excited. You look so sad. Yeah. If you look at this function and you compute the two-dimensional Fourier transform of it, and you go into this function and you just read this line here, yeah, just read the 2D FT values along this line that is parallel to the projection line, you get the Fourier transform of the measurement you do. Or the other way around, if you Fourier transform what you measure with your X-ray detector, you get one line in the function's Fourier transform that you want to reconstruct. Yeah? So what is the computed tomography system doing? It's rotating around the patient and collecting X-ray projections. And if you Fourier transform each of these projections, you get for each projection one line through the 2D Fourier transform you want of the function you want to reconstruct. Then you rotate, you get the second Fourier transform, the third component of the Fourier transform, and that's how you collect the Fourier transforms. So what a CT system is doing, it collects step by step the samples of the Fourier transform of the function to be reconstructed. That's the basic idea. And that also explains why the whole thing has to rotate by 180 degrees around the patient. Yeah? It has to sample the Fourier transform.
That only works for y equals 0.
Right, and that's the argument that is still missing. And I'll explain it to you in a few seconds. For y equals, for theta equals to 0, if you rotate this, then you have to show that for the rotated projection, this also holds true. But what you can do is, I mean, one argument that tells us intuitively that that doesn't matter is because this coordinate system is more or less arbitrarily sitting in space. So you can also rotate the coordinate system and get the same result for another theta. And at the end, you can show, and we are going to do that, you can show it doesn't matter whether you compute the Fourier transform and then rotate, or whether you rotate or you and then compute the Fourier transform. These two operators commute. And that's the proof that it holds, this simple observation holds for all rotation angles.
Does this also work for non-parallel projection?
Yes and no. Wait for Monday. because then we have to look at fan beam projections, and then we look at all the fan beam projections, and we look at those lines that are as parallel as possible, and then we reorganize everything and it works again. Okay? So that is the important thing here. Just for the rotation angle zero, that's the easiest way to show, and it's very easy to see, and there is no deep insight into the math required. It's just using two definitions, the definition of the projection and the definition of the 2D Fourier transform. Very cool result. And if you are asked in the oral exam, explain to me how the Fourier transform of the projection is linked to the Fourier transform of the object to be reconstructed, just explain it the way I put it here on the blackboard. So the computed tomography system is just collecting projections and Fourier transforms. Okay. And now let's show the general case as our Brazilian student has pointed out. We have to show this in general, and we do that also mathematically. And please apologize that I'm always so excited about the topics I teach. I think that's a must for a professor. I had once a math professor who was teaching algebra, advanced course in algebra, and the first sentence he was saying in the lecture is, algebra is very boring and I don't like it. And that was exactly the way the whole lecture was, you know. It was so boring and it just killed me. I survived, but it was not fun. Good. On the other hand, is group theory exciting? Finite fields, is it exciting? Nah. Can you solve practical problems with it? Yeah, sometimes. Good, so we are going to prove it in general. So what we do is we again write the Fourier transform of the projection. So that's the Fourier transform in general in terms of omega and theta. Integral from minus infinity to plus infinity. So I'm repeating myself now a little bit. Ps theta 2 pi I omega s ds. Just the definition. No? Just the definition. It's just the definition. Then we just take the definition again of the projection, and now we take it for arbitrary rotation angles. That means we use the Dirac delta notation. Now we reconsider Dirac delta notation, minus infinity to plus infinity. Then we have the double integral from minus infinity each to plus infinity. Oh, we have a triple integral. Ludwig, exciting, huh?
Yes.
Very exciting. Triple integral. Fx, that's the function we want to reconstruct. Then we have the Dirac delta with the cosine and the sine component minus s dx dy. And then we have the nth root here, e to the power of 2 pi I omega s ds. Okay? Once again, how do we read the Dirac delta? The Dirac delta is 1 if the argument is 0, 0 otherwise. Sir?
Why is there the sinus of
A? That is just my poor handwriting. This is a theta. Sorry for that. Thank you very much. Is it readable? Yishin, is it readable what I write? Yeah? Okay. What I can do now is I can reorganize the whole thing a little bit. Yeah, so we just use the linearity of integrals. So we just move around things in an intelligent way, whatever that means. X cosine theta plus y sine theta minus s. I s w, and now I integrate over s over x and over y. So did something happen? We just moved around things. Huh? We took all the components of s here into this inner integral, and then the outer one goes over x and y as variables. Okay, and what do we do now? I mean, if I integrate over all the s's, there is just a single s where the argument of the integral does not collapse to zero. And which s is it? Pardon me? Right, so. Okay, that's just due to the definition of the Dirac delta function. This is a function that has only at s is equal to x cosine theta y plus y sine theta the value 1. And if this prefactor is 1, we just get here the nth or the e function at the position x cosine theta plus y sine theta. And that's what I wrote here. Okay? And now you look again at it and you say, hey man, that looks very much like a 2D Fourier transform of fx, but there is something wrong with it. You still feel uncomfortable with the trigonometric functions here. So let's rewrite it a little bit. So it goes from minus infinity, I'm sorry for the dirt here, fx. And y, e to the power of minus pi i, and now I write here omega cosine theta, and put it in brackets, times x, plus omega sine theta in brackets times y dx dy. Okay? And if I call this here zeta and eta, then you would say, hey, cool, that's the 2D Fourier transform of the original function fx according to the definition. So this is exactly the Fourier transform, and we use capital letters for the Fourier transform of the original function f, yeah, capital F at the position x cosine theta y sine theta. Now we have shown the relationship of the Fourier transform of the projection with the Fourier transform of the function we want to reconstruct right away. The only disadvantage here is that's the 2D Fourier transform. 2D Fourier transform. Of f of x. And the only ugly thing, and that generated work for hundreds of researchers worldwide, what I'm saying now, the only negative thing here is that the Fourier transform is not given in terms of Cartesian coordinates, but in terms of, I have a mistake here. This is an omega, yes. Please, yeah, 2 degrees of freedom, theta and omega, of f of x in polar coordinates. Coordinates, you know what's going to come here, in polar coordinates. And let's illustrate this a little bit. Let's assume we have here the zeta eta space. That's the two dimensions of the Fourier transform. And we say we measure the 2D Fourier transform along this projection or detector line. That means we get the Fourier transform here in terms of detector coordinates. If I rotate around, I get here a value, here a value, here a value, and so on. If I rotate, I get here a value, here, 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 here. And then I get many more projections. So I sample the 2D Fourier transform in terms of polar coordinates. Yeah? Give me the rotation angle and then the position on the detector element. So I get the 2D Fourier transform in polar coordinates. I get the whole thing in polar coordinates. And does that make us happy? No, because reconstruction means we have to compute just the inverse of the Fourier transform and get the original function. So how does a CT work again? We rotate around the patient. We compute the x-ray projections according to Bayer's law. We compute the I0 normalization and the logarithm and the minus sign. Then we compute the Fourier transform. We take the Fourier transform, put it into the 2D space for the Fourier transform of the function we want to reconstruct. If we have a 180 degree at least rotation, we have a good sampling, equidistant sampling of the Fourier transform in polar coordinates. Then we apply the inverse Fourier transform and we are done with the reconstruction. The only problem is that we measure the Fourier transform of the function we are interested in polar coordinates. So we have to apply the inverse Fourier transform on a Fourier transformed function that is given in polar coordinates. And of course, we want to have the result also in Cartesian coordinates. So we have to work now on coordinate transforms. Yeah? And what we see also intuitively, and that makes things intuitively clear, the closer we are to the rotation center, the more samples we have of the Fourier transform. The farther out we are from the rotation the farther we are away from the rotation center, the more the lines here diverge and the sparser the samples will be. That's also a reason why we always try to put our patient right into the center of the scanner, because there is the point where we get the most samples. And in the middle here, the central point that defines the rotation axis, has the characteristics that you have here the most measurements, because you measure this point in all the projections. You measure this point in all the projections. And what you can do, for instance, here is you can look at this measurement for various projections, and you can use this, for instance, to recognize whether the patient has moved, because then this value will change significantly. Yeah, so for motion detection of the patient, this is, for instance, used. There is way more done, but good. Okay, got it? So we have to talk about coordinate transforms. We will later go into the slides. I always prefer to explain things on the blackboard, and I'm having the better speed. Yes. So, reconstruction. Is nothing else but the following. Take the Fourier transform. Of theta and eta, and compute the inverse Fourier transform. So the function fxy that we have considered in Baer's law and we want to reconstruct can be computed out of the Fourier transform using the inverse Fourier transform. The inverse Fourier transform differs from the Fourier transform by just the sign and the scaling factor. Yeah? Hand-waving math lecture, we just forget about the scaling factor and we have here plus. And this is true for Cartesian coordinates as it is written here. Yeah? It's true for Cartesian coordinates. So we have to apply a coordinate transform. And the wonderful thing here in an advanced lecture is that you know from your math classes how to do a coordinate transform in integrals. How? Well, we are now transforming our theta to omega cosine theta, our theta to omega cosine theta, and our eta is omega sine theta. Yeah? That's the transform we apply. Our theta is transformed into omega cosine theta, our eta is converted into omega sine theta. And this assignment is unique, because we can represent the 2D coordinates by cosine and sine theta value and a scaling factor along this line. Yeah? Good. What we have to put into the integral is the determinant of the Jacobian as a factor if we apply this coordinate transform. Yeah? If we have just rotations and you forgot about the Jacobian, it's very easy because the determinant of the rotation matrix is 1 and nothing happens. So many students are in a good shape if they don't remember and they have to deal with just rotations of coordinate systems. But here it's a little different. Here the Jacobian is non-trivial. And how is the Jacobian defined? The Jacobian. The Jacobian of this here, J, is, well, that's the derivative with respect to the first degree of freedom, omega, and the derivative with respect to the second degree of freedom, theta. So what is the derivative of cosine theta, of omega cosine theta with respect to omega? Well, this is cosine theta, sine theta, because this is a linear in omega, so the first derivative is just one with respect to omega. What is the derivative with respect to theta? Well, this is omega. The cosine function looks like this, yeah? So it starts with one, and then it goes down. So the derivative is minus sine of theta. And here we have plus omega cosine theta. That's the Jacobian. And the determinant of the Jacobian is cosine theta times cosine theta is cosine theta square times omega minus sine theta times minus omega sine theta. So we have here omega times cosine square theta plus sine square theta. And this is omega. Okay? And now we replace here the two elements by omega cosine theta, omega sine theta, and multiplied with the Jacobian as it is required by the coordinate transform for integral transformation. So, Ludwig, do you remember this with the Jacobian? Yes. And now buckle up, because the excitement level now goes to infinity in a few seconds. The excitement level about all the math goes to infinity in a few seconds. So we plug it in. So we have integral, two integrals. The theta goes from 0 to 2 pi, because that's the rotation angle, and we rotate around the object completely, okay? From 2 to 2 pi. We have some redundancy in there, because we know that if you have parallel projections, things repeat themselves independent from which direction I compute the projection. So look at the integral, and you see in front of the integral a factor of 2. In your brain, yeah? In your imagination, there is a factor of 2, because I kill it in a few seconds again, so I don't write it at all. Then we have from minus infinity to plus infinity the omega. But the omega is just the scaling factor of our, it's the scaling factor of our unit vector in terms of the polar coordinate. So we just look usually at positive values of omega. If we go from omega, omega values from minus infinity to plus infinity, we again count things twice. Yeah, so there is some imaginated prefactor, but we ignore it. And to make it positive, always we use instead of omega absolute value. Yeah. So think about the polar coordinates. If you rotate around the object, and you have here your theta, you go just the positive values, And if you want to have the negative values on the line here, you usually go this way for the rotation angle. So we only look at positive values and integrate over the positive values. Good. So that was just a side note. And then we have our 2D Fourier transform in polar coordinates. 2D Fourier transform in polar coordinates. And then we have to write everything here into the exponent properly. So it's x times cosine theta plus y sine theta. D omega and d theta. These are our integration variables. Okay.
Why don't we have to replace the arguments in the cosine and the Fourier transform with x cosine theta?
That actually we did. Well, we now rewrite f omega cosine theta omega sine theta and say this is f of omega theta. It's just the writing we are using here. So I have written this in, yes? Yes, we do. And here I have it also with plus, so it was just my mistake here on the fly. Okay. Good. So we multiply the absolute value of omega with the Fourier transform in polar coordinates, and here we have the E function that does the Fourier transform for us, the back transform, the inverse Fourier transform. So let me reorganize this a little bit. Integral from 0 to 2 pi. Integral from minus infinity to plus infinity. Omega d omega d theta. This here is the Fourier transform of the function we look for in polar coordinates. This is the same as the Fourier transform of all the projections in omega and theta. So I can replace this by P of omega theta. That's the 2D Fourier transform of all the 1D measurements I have. Yeah? That's just by definition. E to the power 2p pi I x cosine theta plus y sine theta times this. What? Omega. Yes, we lost the omega here. Yeah. Good. Okay. And now look at this. This is the product of the Fourier transform of the measurement, of the measurements, with the absolute value of omega. A product of a Fourier transform with another function in the same variables. That's a product of two Fourier transforms. No? You can say omega, absolute value of omega is the Fourier transform of something. And if we have a product of Fourier transform, your bell in your outer shell of your brain is ringing. What is it telling? It's convolution. That means what we do is in spatial domain, we filter the observations. We filter the observations by a filter that's with a filter kernel that's having the Fourier transform omega absolute value. So the determinant, the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian is considered to be a filter. And now remember the picture I have shown to you where we smear the detector values over the function to be reconstructed. And I said you have to put in some negative values to make sure that the final result is showing just the one point you want to reconstruct. This omega absolute value is exactly the filter we have to apply. Yeah? And now let's check for plausibility. Why does this filter make sense? This here corresponds to a filter ring in spatial domain, even a linear filtering, yeah, because just the convolutions can be expressed in terms of linear filters, so it's a convolution. And now once again, besides all the math, always keep track of the your mental picture of the whole situation. Does this make sense? It makes sense. Let me come up with a figure again. Ludwig, you're following me on the excitement level 500? Okay. And beyond. We sample the Fourier transform in polar coordinates. That's the Fourier transform in polar coordinates. And what we see here is a lot of points are squeezed in the center and they are getting sparser and far away if I am far away from the rotation center. Okay? Good. Now let's look at the function omega absolute value. Looks like this. And now we multiply this with each line. That's actually what's written here. We multiply this Fourier transform with this Fourier transform for a given theta. So we decide on a theta. And we take this function and multiply all the values with this v. That basically means, yeah, and now we are on excitement level 5000, that those points that are close to the center get a lower weight than those points that are far away. What makes actually sense, because in the middle we have a lot of information, outside we have not so much information. So the outer ones, the value of a measurement that is far away from the center should have a higher impact on the result than those measurements that sit in the center, because in the center we have a lot of samples and outside we have not so many. Yeah? So by just the brute force Fourier transform, coordinate transform, we have found out that here this is a filtering operation that can be well explained by just looking at the situation. So a good engineer might come up with this picture without having all the math, but a good intuition. Yeah? And then you can do all the math. Is there anybody in the lecture hall who is not following this argument? No. We have no time to discuss it again. Yeah? Everybody understood that. So what we need to do is now the following. Look at this formula here. Look at this formula here. We have to we have to take our observation, measurement, we have to Fourier transform our measurement, we have to multiply it with the absolute value of omega, and then do the inverse Fourier transform. And that we do for all the theta. So we convolve the signal that we measure with the inverse Fourier transform of this. And then we integrate over all the angles. That means we take one angle and smear everything over it. We take the next angle and smear everything over it. That's nothing else what the integral here is doing. That's the so-called back projection step. And the filtering operation is the filtering step. And the algorithm that we end up with is the filtered back projection algorithm that is also called in the literature FBP, filtered back projection. We filter the signal and then we do the integration over all the angles here. And now within the big companies that build computer tomographs, there are people sitting there, whole team, 10 people. They start in the morning at 8 to work, and they go back home at 6 in the evening, and they do nothing else but thinking about this absolute value of omega and to find a good discrete approximation of this filtering operation. Yeah? And the vendors, they defer in the decision on the omega absolute value. And if you run an scanner of one of the vendors, it says, do you want to have high contrast object reconstruction or low contrast object reconstructions? And then you can set a tag what type of reconstruction you want to have. And the only thing what differs in the two reconstruction methods is basically the implementation of the absolute value of omega, the filtering operation. For high contrast objects, it's a little different than for low contrast objects. Or if you are with a Siemens scanner, the Siemens guys over engineered systems quite often, right? They use even the name of the filtering operations that are used in literature. So the doctor knows about the name of the filters with having no idea what actually is done to approximate the omega absolute value. So if you go to the radiology department, you get a CT scan, and the doctor tells you, we have here the CT image, and this is the result, and here we see this and that. You can ask, what type of filter or what type of approximation of the absolute value function did you use for reconstruction? And then they might tell you Ramlak or Shep-Logan or whatever is out there. And what we are going now to discuss in the following is how we can choose the omega absolute value function in practice, and what is the impact on the reconstruction. And in the second part of the reconstruction lectures, we will talk about different acquisition geometries and how you can deal with them by using these theoretical results. Why don't we just use the implementation of the absolute value of omega? There are two things that make it uncomfortable. The integral goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. So we have to cut it somewhere. And the question is, where do we cut it? And we have here in the theoretical part the assumption that we have an infinite number of observations. That means the center object is weighted by zero. And in practice, we have a finite number of projections. So we have to correct for this in the discretization. And that is why the design of this filtering operation is so difficult, yeah, and painful at some point. Thank you very much. We quit here and see you on Monday. Thank you.